This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, April 4, 2006, from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll go to Capitol Hill, where Republicans in the Senate are working behind the scenes on alternate immigration legislation. Thailand's political crisis has been diffused as the Prime Minister announces his resignation. And a fifth day of major actions in France against the proposed youth employment law. We'll bring you these stories and much more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Israeli forces have launched new strikes against the Gaza Strip, damaging part of the Palestinian presidential compound. One Palestinian man was killed and eight others were wounded in northern Gaza. Leila Haddad has more.
After roaring over Gaza's skies throughout the morning, Israeli fighter jets attacked several targets in Gaza City, including Mahmoud Abbas's presidential compound. Palestinian witnesses say two missiles struck the compound, destroying part of the president's helicopter landing pad and leaving an enormous crater in the area, which is also used to train Palestinian security forces. Mahmoud Abbas was not in his office at the time, which is less than 100 meters from the site of the attack. Later, a Palestinian man was killed and several members of his family injured, including a baby, after Israeli tanks shelled civilian areas in northern Gaza in retaliation for rocket fire into Israel. Israel has also closed off the El Mintad commercial crossing into Gaza again, despite UN warnings that the Strip is on the verge of a humanitarian disaster. Last month, Palestinians faced unprecedented food shortages after a prolonged closure of the crossing that saw the depletion of wheat stocks, bread, and dairy products. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
Saddam Hussein will now face genocide charges for a brutal campaign in the late 80s that targeted villages in the Kurdish region of Iraq. As many as 180 died in the Anwar campaign, including 5,000 during the gassing of the village of Halabja in 1988. Six others will join Saddam Hussein as co-defendants, among them Saddam's cousin, Ali Hassan Al-Majid, also known as Chemical Ali. A trial date has not been set. The top United Nations official on humanitarian affairs has had to call off the remainder of an African tour in the face of what has been called systemic obstruction. Yesterday, the government of Sudan prevented UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Jan Engeland, from visiting the Darfur region. Today, Khartoum declined to give permission for England to fly over Darfur on his way to Chad to visit refugees displaced by the conflict. Also today, Sudanese authorities told members of the Norwegian Refugee Council to end all humanitarian operations in Darfur and to leave the region. An estimated 2 million people have been displaced by 3 years of fighting in Darfur. The Sudanese government is accused of supporting militias in the region. Nepal's government today placed a ban on public demonstrations in Kathmandu. The announcement comes just 2 days before a planned general strike. And as PC Dubey reports, FM radio stations have also been pressured to carry government-sponsored messages to discourage participation in the strike.
The four-day general strike called by the seven political parties from April 6 to 9 to protest King Gyanendra's autocracy could create problems for independent radio stations due to their refusal to broadcast an official message against the strike. Last week, the Home Ministry sent letters to independent FM stations in Kathmandu asking them to air a paid message that urged people to refrain from participating in the strike. The message also said that security forces could take action to contain so-called terrorist activities among the strikers. The FM radios have refused to air the material, arguing that it could instill unnatural fear and panic in the general public prohibited by the National Broadcasting Act of 1993. This is the second time that independent radios have refused to air government propaganda since the royal coup on February 1, 2005. When independent stations refused to air material provided by the Defense Ministry in February of 2005, some 50 stations were shut down by royal decree. As for this week's general strike, the Maoist rebels have declared a ceasefire during the protest while the government has announced a ban on demonstrations in the capital. From Kathmandu, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
Republican Congressman Tom DeLay has announced his resignation amid an ongoing corruption scandal. Katie Heim reports from Houston.
The voters of the 22nd District of Texas deserve a campaign about the vital national issues that they care most about and that affect their lives every day, and not a campaign focused solely as a referendum on me.
Despite earlier promises to fight for his seat in Houston's 22nd district, House Representative Tom DeLay announced last night that he will withdraw from the race. Once regarded as one of the most powerful Republicans in the country, DeLay vowed to step down before the end of his final term. DeLay's former deputy chief of staff pleaded guilty to a conspiracy charge last week, leading some to speculate on new evidence against the former House leader, who was indicted on money laundering charges in 2005. DeLay says he is stepping down to spare his district a mudfest in this year's election campaign. However, fear of losing the hard-won Republican control of Texas may have been a driving force in this decision. Republicans are now scrambling to replace the congressman in a race for control of the U.S. House of Representatives. For Free Speech Radio News in Houston, I'm Katie Heim.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Thailand's political crisis has been suddenly diffused as Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra announced his resignation. His announcement was broadcast last night on national television just one day after the controversial prime minister asserted he would remain in office. FSRN Severine Bardon reports from Bangkok.
In a speech delivered last night, Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra announced his resignation after months of protests calling for him to step down. He said his reason for doing so was in deference to the king's 60th year on the throne. Thaksin then apologized to his 16 million supporters and said he would carry on as the caretaker prime minister until his successor is chosen. The abrupt change occurred after Thaksin met with King Bhumibol, a much-revered personality in the country. Every opposition party and organization that accused Thaksin of corruption called for him to step aside. But this sudden development doesn't solve all of the country's current political problems. 38 out of the 500 seats in the parliament are still empty after candidates failed to win 20% of the votes required for candidates running without opponents. Even among those elected, a large number of them received less votes than the no vote in their constituencies. By elections are already planned this weekend to fill in the 38 empty seats, but the legitimacy of the elected deputies from the majority is questioned. Abhisit Vejjachiva is the leader of the main opposition party in Thailand.
People can say what they want. For example, a candidate elected with only a few thousand votes can say he won the elections, even though tens of thousands of citizens have been expressing a no vote. That is to say, they voted against him. Legally, we can consider that this candidate is a deputy, but he has to ask himself whether he deserves to be a representative of the people. The answer to the question is very clear.
The question now is how much the population will trust the newly elected parliament that will be mainly composed of Thai Rak Thai, the prime minister's party, due to the boycott by the opposition parties. Sunay Pasuk, who took part in the drafting of the so-called People's Constitution in 1997, is now a representative of Human Rights Watch in Thailand.
Because of the ability of the party, of Thai Rak Thai party, to manipulate, to control, check and balance mechanism, then even if Thaksin stepped down, the people who didn't vote for Thai Rak Thai would not trust that political reform will be done in a genuine manner, or there will be a transparent investigation into the alleged misconduct of the prime minister. So the ideal, the proposal is that not only Thaksin step down, but Thai Rak Thai, the entire Thai Rak Thai bunch, will step down as well, and then Thailand will have an interim government.
Another worrying question is whether the new parliament will be able to convene at all. The constitution doesn't allow it to open until all the 500 representatives are elected, and the by-elections seem to be unlikely to solve the problem. Citizens who voted for the prime minister's party still have to digest the news of his resignation, and Thaksin's opponents understand that they'll have to cope with this prime minister for an unknown period of time. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Bangkok.
The sounds of demonstrators in France, which saw a fifth day of action today when hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of up to 200 towns and cities to protest against the government's youth employment plan, the First Employment Contract, or CPE, for its French acronym. Fewer workers took strike action today than in the past weeks, but the protest marches are still massive, with numbers estimated to be higher in the southern port city of Marseille, the western city of Bordeaux, and a massive turnout in Paris. FSRN's Tony Cross reports from the French capital.
Camarades et citoyens, hein, bien sûr. Donc un petit rappel, là, c'est CPO épisode 5.
Comrades, citizens, welcome to the fifth episode of the fight against the CPE, declares a union loudspeaker at the beginning of another protest against the government's first employment contract. Strike action had less effect today than last Tuesday, and the trade union presence on the Paris demonstration seems smaller. But the turnout of students and high school students is, if anything, bigger. The government scheme introduces a new contract for workers under 26, which enables them to be fired at any time. José is a student who has gone back to university after several years at work. He understands that the contract might not sound shocking to the public in the US, but he thinks that France is different.
En France, je pense qu'on n'a pas l'économie.
I think in France, we don't have a sufficiently dynamic economy or bosses who invest enough for this sort of contract to work. I think that's specific to the US, which has a very dynamic economy which has dominated the world for a very long time. It's a big, big country, a continent, and that's nothing like France. If we want to keep the rights that we've won here, I think we have to fight for them.
On Friday, President Jacques Chirac endorsed the law, which includes the CPE, but he promised some changes and gave the governing party, the UMP, the task of discussing with students and workers' unions. And while we're waiting, ministers have asked employers not to use the new contract. The high school students' union, FIDEL, didn't obey. Yesterday, it signed up one of its members on a CPE and sacked him 25 minutes later to show what the plan could mean to young workers. Lassara Drami is Fidel's secretary general. He says that the union will keep up the fight after today's demonstrations.
We'll be on the streets until the law is repealed. It's outrageous that when 3 million people are on the streets, the government turns a deaf ear to our demands. They're being stubborn. The tougher they are with us, the tougher we'll be with them.
So union leaders are upbeat, but the government must be counting on the movement slacking off. There'll be another face-off tomorrow. The government party's working group says that it's ready to see union leaders one by one to talk about changing the law. So far, union representatives say they want to go together and talk about completely scrapping it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
Immigration legislation is advancing slowly in the Senate, where a behind-the-scenes compromise orchestrated by Republicans may be used as alternate legislation that they hope would unite the GOP and garner enough support to pass the Senate. Meanwhile, immigrant rights advocates are planning two separate days of national boycotts in April and May to reveal the benefits immigrants contribute to the U.S. economy. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
Senators believe it will be difficult to finish immigration legislation this week. Since little progress is being made, two Senate Republicans proposed compromise legislation to their fellow GOP. The compromise offered by Mel Martinez of Florida and Chuck Hagel of Nebraska aims to please those who want only a guest worker program and oppose a path to citizenship, which opponents call amnesty. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina.
I believe there's a shift to the idea that a comprehensive bill is the preferred solution for the nation and the party, and that the leadership provided by the president's paying dividends, and that the sense of compromise is in the air.
Details are not set in stone, but it is intended to garner the 60 votes that will be necessary for it to pass the Senate. Several senators revealed some possibilities of the proposal. Immigrants who have lived in the United States for less than 5 years will have to report their status, but they will not necessarily have to go back to their country of origin to do that. They could check in at their point of entry or the closest U.S. airport, for example. Another proposal would be to give current undocumented immigrants probation. Their penalty could be community service or paying back taxes into Social Security. Senator John McCain, co-author of the comprehensive legislation offered on the Senate floor, now known as the Specter Bill, hinted that he would support the Republican compromise if it was able to pass the Senate.
So I've got to pursue what I think is a viable way of approaching it.
But Democrats signaled they would not accept a compromise. Democratic leader Harry Reid.
A bill that's bipartisan came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee on a bipartisan basis. It covers strong, secure borders, a guest worker program, and a path to legalization for the people about whom you just spoke. We don't need a compromise. It's here.
Meanwhile, immigrant rights advocates are planning a national day of boycott on May 1st to oppose legislation that would criminalize them. They are calling on all immigrants to miss work, to miss school, and to not buy or sell anything on that day. Juan Jose Gutierrez is director of Latino Movement USA.
So that the society once and for all understands who immigrants are. First and foremost, workers and contributors who do not deserve to be abused in the humiliating way that they have for all these years.
And on April 10th, the National Day of Solidarity for Immigrants is called for. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The House passed its $91 billion emergency supplemental package in mid-March for additional money to fund military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as for additional assistance for post-hurricane Gulf Coast rebuilding. Now it's the Senate's turn to decide their version of the package. FSRN Selena Masuta reports from the Senate on amendments being introduced to the bill today that could make that $91 billion price tag much higher.
Tuesday, the Senate Appropriation Committee members met to mark up the fiscal 2006 emergency supplemental spending bill, which will exceed by several billion dollars the amount requested by President Bush, and as well the amount approved in the House version. Appropriations Chairman Thad Cochran and Subcommittee Chairman Ted Stevens, an Alaskan Republican, presented the committee the $95 billion supplemental with the hope that it would pass with few amendments. However, requests from Republican and Democratic Senate members for non-related Katrina relief and war funding, including money for farm relief programs and to fight the avian flu, could raise the price of the bill to $100 billion. Some senators say that the focus of the supplemental is too narrow. Democratic Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia.
I am disappointed that no funding is included for reducing the costs of future disasters. I am disappointed that the president continues, with all due respect to the president, continues to request funds for the war in Iraq on an ad hoc emergency basis. If the president's supplemental request is approved, Congress will have appropriated $321 billion of emergency spending for the war in Iraq.
Despite concerns over military spending, Democratic opponents of the war, like Chris Dodd of Connecticut, say they may still vote for additional funding.
Well, I'm always supportive of our troops, and how much of this goes to support our troops is a very important issue for me. It's not their decision to be there. They're told to be someplace, and I don't want to ever undercut their ability to get what they need as men and women in uniform. Even though I have strong disagreements about the conduct of this war, my inclination would be to support the supplemental to make sure our troops get the resources they deserve.
The full Senate is expected to vote by the end of April or sooner. Selena Masuda, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip fired scores of homemade shells at Israeli targets, although no damage was reported. The Israeli military renewed its shelling of residential areas in the north of the Gaza Strip, killing two civilians and injuring eight others, including a mother and her six-month-old child. Israeli army forces also assassinated a leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the armed wing of Fatah. FSRN's Manar Jabrin reports from Bethlehem, where another leader was injured and arrested in a military operation by Israeli Special Army units.
The Israeli army invaded the West Bank town of Beit Sahur, adjacent to Bethlehem, and killed Raed Ubayat, 31, a father of four, who was hiding with Raed Abu Jura inside a building in the town. Both are members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Israeli soldiers dragged Abu Jura down the stairs, shot him, and then arrested him. One of several witnesses, building resident Ibrahim Abu Farha, said he heard explosions and gunfire before Ubayyat was killed. He added that the army prevented the residents from viewing the scene.
What happened was there was an explosion before they left, and the explosions and the destruction continued in the building until the army withdrew. When we came down to the parking area, we saw the martyr lying dead on the ground.
Sharif Abu Hadid, a resistance fighter in Bethlehem, says Ubayyat had been a target of the Israeli military for some time.
He has been wanted for 5 years. The army has attempted more than once to arrest and to assassinate him. Members of his family have been arrested several times.
Extrajudicial killings are prohibited under international law, yet Israeli government has carried out numerous military operations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, killing members of the Palestinian resistance factions through invasions or by firing missiles from gunships across residential areas, causing the death of many civilians, including children. This is Manar Jibreen for FSR and from IMMC.org, Bethlehem, Palestine.
Condoleezza Rice's visit to the north of England to Foreign Secretary Jack Straw's constituency began with demonstrations against her visit and ended with a sudden joint visit to Iraq. Naomi Fowler reports on her reception in the UK.
This trip was always going to be controversial. Not only that, but personally risky for Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, who has a large number of Muslim constituents and strong anti-war feeling across Britain that's done a lot of damage to the Labour government. One US diplomat said, "The only thing I'm looking forward to is the moment when it's over." Well, the visit is now over, leaving observers in Britain to debate the tactic of Condoleezza Rice in publicly admitting to mistakes.
"I know we've made tactical errors, thousands of them, I'm sure. This could have gone that way or that could have gone that way. But when you look back in history, what will be judged is, did you make the right strategic decision?"
Politicians like Pat Doherty, speaking in this public meeting, believe we may not have to wait that long.
"Well, 1,000 tactical errors surely is nearly or should equate to a huge strategic error. They should never have done what they did. They should never have invaded Iraq. It's a disaster. It's a disaster for the people of Iraq. It's a disaster for the American people. It's a disaster for the British troops and the American troops who are there, who are dying in their dozens and sometimes in their hundreds. The whole thing from beginning to end is about oil and about the control of oil. It's not about democracy. But if it was about democracy, they would have invaded half of the world."
Even former Minister Douglas Hurd of Mrs. Thatcher's government was critical of the US.
"He's the superpower, which is going to stay a superpower for, 20 or 30 years more without challenge, but not forever. Is it actually prepared to listen seriously to others, as opposed to believing, as rather appeared in the first Bush term, that because they were mighty and because they were righteous, because they had this mission for freedom in the world, that they just put together what coalition they could? I think this is a crucial point, this tone as well as substance."
Publicly admitting mistakes may be a change in tone, but the essential message delivered here has been the same. Like it or not, the British government remains a strong ally for the US in Iraq, despite strong opposition from the British public. This is Naomi Fowler in Lancashire for Free Speech Radio News.
The curtain has closed on a part of Washington, D.C., which has been a safe haven to gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders for over 30 years. The historic Half and O Street area, known for its drag shows and strip clubs, as well as its sense of community, especially for gay youth, is ordered to completely vacate by Wednesday to make room for a new stadium paid for by D.C. taxpayers. FSRN's Darby Hickey brings us the voices of people who say they're outraged at what the city has done.
"It's unique. It holds history for a whole generation, several generations of people coming up. Young people hang out here. Memorial Day, so this is a big space."
25-year-old Andreas is just one of many people, especially youth, who will be displaced by the imminent destruction of one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest gay districts in order to build a publicly funded baseball stadium. Andreas and many others spoke with FSRN about the importance of the space.
"I think it's absolutely terrible that we've built so much as a community, and that is just all wiped away all at once without our say, without our voices being heard.
Why do you think the voices of folks here aren't being heard?
Because of politics and money dominating what's important in the city. We're basically just being trampled on, our identity and part of our culture.
This is our little area, you know? It's our area. We don't have very many areas in the city. It's our area, you know? So, you know, they feel they're going to take it away, they're going to take it away.
People always looking at the negative side of things, but they don't see the positive side and how a lot of people grow and how a lot of people have family down here. You know, it's not like we're just friends down here, but we are also become a family.
On Wednesday, April 5th, all remaining businesses and residents in the footprint of the new stadium must be completely vacated from their properties. The D.C. government has seized 20 acres of land in this old warehouse district, which became a safe haven for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgenders, drag performers, and others since the first clubs opened nearby in 1971. Black gay youth will be particularly affected by the change, as this area has been a popular and relatively safe hangout spot for many years. The displacement of a marginalized community to make way for development is part of a larger pattern of gentrification, says Victor Price, a staff member at the LGBT youth-serving organization SMILE. Price says the city should be ashamed of its failure to provide more safe spaces for these young people.
For youth, I think the value is that it is the actual space, that is so many clubs there. It is a space for them to hang out and not be, because they can't get into a club. And I think that there's value in it, just that people can come together in that kind of way. And I think while it has value that that's a place where youth hang, we need to also know that as a community of people that live in D.C. and reside in D.C., that means that there's a deficit.
The clubs in the area include strip clubs and drag bars that have closed. Although some may question the value of such venues, Mark Meinke of the Rainbow History Project tells the crucial role these spaces played, especially in years past, for a community faced with prejudice and violence.
Actually having our own clubs to go to, even the sleazy sex-retainment clubs, was a step up. It was a step out of the shadows. And, you know, then you might meet somebody that would become your life partner, or you might meet somebody that would introduce you to somebody, or you would begin to have a circle of friends who were like you.
As of now, none of the clubs closed by the evictions have been able to relocate. On the final night that the clubs were open, hundreds of people crowded into the area to say goodbye to where they had developed a sense of community and ended their isolation. And when legendary drag queen Xavier Bloomingdale asked the crowd, "What will we do when they build the stadium?" the crowd roared back, "Burn it down." For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Southeast Washington, D.C.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also email us your comments or story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.